Hello. In this audio recording, we were thinking about continuing to talk about America in the post-Civil War period after the election of 1876. But for some reason, I felt compelled to talk about what might seem like a completely different subject. To what we've been talking about, but I guess it is, in a sense, a complement to what we were talking about in the previous recording on false contracts. And it's a very simple concept, so I don't know how long this recording might go, even though usually I think it's going to be short, but it ends up going long. But the basic concept that we want to share this time is relatively straightforward, but I believe it's worth mentioning and having this recording done on that, however simple concept, because it is relevant, we believe, and for some reason I could not get away from sharing that today. It's as if that's what this recording had to be about, even though I thought it would not have much content to talk about, or even if I thought that we wanted to continue with the Civil War things, post-Civil War period. So that's what we will talk about, because that's what apparently we need to talk about this time. So before we get to that small but important concept, we wanted to share a few things. First, just as additional reinforcement points, you could say, on the previous recording, even though we said it before, we wanted to kind of share it again, maybe in a slightly different way, to emphasize the idea, and it's that false contracts, the false contracts we were talking about before, are built on indirect relationship with the quote truth. And in other words, people write establish a contract with the elite priests, and they may not call themselves priests, but that's what they are. It's a religious contract. You kind of sign a contract of loyalty to an ideology, just as if it was a religion. And this religion has a caste of priests who define the checklists that the contract has, and as you check things off, then you are granted these labels, and these labels are, like tags that you wear, and you point to them and say, "Hey, this is what I am." No matter if your behavior starts contradicting the label, but because you have been awarded this certificate by this religion, then or this elite priesthood, then it really does not matter what your behavior is afterwards, on a different topic that's not on the list, because you already won it's like having a diploma. You already got the diploma, so it doesn't matter if you really don't know the subject matter. You already have the diploma, so you can claim you know the subject matter, or that you live by it. So, but it's a relationship with this priesthood. And this priesthood claims to have a relationship with the truth. So basically, it's like they handle the truth, and then they come down from the mountaintop with a list of things you have to live by, the contract, and then you just subscribe to the contract. But it and you claim to have a connection with the truth somehow, because you have a connection with the priesthood, which has in turn a connection with the quote truth. So it is based on indirect relationships. And that's where the problem starts, because that's why people don't see the contradiction in their behavior versus the label they have, quote, earned by checking off certain things in the checklist, because they don't understand the label. And why don't they understand the label they so proudly wear? Because they don't have a connection to the truth. So they don't have an intimate knowledge of what compassion is, or they don't have an intimate knowledge of what tolerance is. They don't have an intimate knowledge of empathy. They don't have an intimate knowledge of what it means to really care about the environment. They don't have an intimate understanding of what it means to care about women, and women being treated fairly. We talked about all these examples. Or they don't have an intimate understanding of what it means about caring for the rights of people in other countries and so forth. So they end up doing all these hypocritical, contradictory things, and they don't see the contradiction because they don't have a direct relationship with the truth. So it's just a label. That's all it is. But they really don't understand the label. It just feels good to have the label, and that's really as far as it goes, because the relationship is indirect with the truth. The contract is made with the priesthood, and the priesthood claims to have a relationship with the truth. And we want to mention, it's like someone who learns a few formulas to solve very specific problems, but who doesn't understand really the theory or the subject matter or why the formulas work. So it's like they just have this recipe. Okay, if you have this certain issue, you deal with it with this formula, this formula, this formula. But even if the formula works, and even if they're doing it right for that specific problem, which is not the case most of the time with these false contracts, but even if it was the right formula to apply to whatever situation, they just apply the formula, but they don't really understand it. And the thing is, once you give them a problem that is not on the list, they have no idea on how to solve it. You know, it's like a physics student who only knows, okay, these are the four formulas for motion, for uniform acceleration, one-dimensional linear, you know, motion, and they learn to use this is form. You use formula number two when the problem is more or less like this. You use formula number three when the problem is like this, and so forth. But if you give them a problem, a physics problem that's slightly different from those very specific problems, they have no idea how to solve the problem. They don't know how to use the four formulas to get to the problem, because the methodology is not there. They don't understand how to use the formulas, and they don't even understand why the formulas work. You change the problem a bit, and they are completely clueless. That's why liberals, for example, if you change the compassion, you know, they're supposed to behave a certain way under very specific examples, and that proves that they're compassionate. But if you give them an example where that is different from those specific things that they have to check off, then they don't understand what compassion is. They just don't know how to be compassionate because they don't have the formula for it. That's more or less what false contracts creates, people like that. Or it's like someone who memorizes some commands to run a machine, for example, or knows, you know, to do this, you press this button, you press this button, you press this button, but they don't really know. They know the physical location of the button on the machine, but they don't understand what the button does, why they have to press that button, and why in that sequence. They're just mechanically pressing the command, or typing in the commands, or pressing buttons, but they don't understand what the commands do or what or why the buttons or and if the problem is slightly different from the ones that there's that they have learned to tackle, they are clueless. They can't apply the knowledge they have to fix a or to tackle a different problem because they don't understand what the commandments do. They don't understand what the buttons on the machine do. They don't even know, you know, this red button, what is it for? Who knows? I just know I have to press this one and then the blue one and then the yellow one and then the problem problem XYZ is going to be solved. But if you give them problem XYK, then suddenly they have no idea. That's kind of the type of people that false contracts create. And just to give you an example, part of why I felt this confirmation in my inner being about having to talk about some of these things is when there was a, I think yesterday or the day before the day of this recording, I believe, the Screen Actors Guild in Hollywood, if I'm not mistaken, decided to go on strike. So all the writers and everybody have gone on strike. And it's over some concern about the use of artificial intelligence. I really don't know the details about it. So I really don't have a view. My intuition kind of feels like maybe that they have a point in going on strike. But my greater sense of it is this is part of the, you know, the collapse and the death of the country. And I think this strike is symbolic of that, you know, that after we have had this cultural drought and it's becoming even more and more intense as the years have gone by, as we've come closer and closer to the death of the country, where, you know, we started to lose our creativity. The music is just rubbish now. It's just, as I've shared before, you know, I don't know why every song seems to have what I call the mosquito sound. It's like they have this, like, synthesizer sound, and they just, like, modulate the voice with this high pitch. I don't know how to explain it. I think there might be a name for what they use, and I think, I don't know, someone started it, maybe Justin Bieber or someone must have started this trend, and or a group, certain group of artists or whatever some years ago, and now every song sounds the same. There is no creativity. It's just staleness, and well, on television, same thing. You start seeing all these rebooting of shows, recreations of old shows. It's like they just don't have any new ideas to come up with. So there's this cultural drought. And as the country dies, you know, 2 or 3 months from now, then the creativity will be gone. There will be, like, again, a residue of what we used to be. And that's going to continue. It's like, you know, we will be running on fumes. And we're starting to run on fumes already, but, you know, by the time the country's dead, it's going to be, you know, on fumes only. And the creativity that was there, I don't know if this word exists, but dynamicity, that vibrancy that we used to have culturally, of creating will be gone. And I think this actor, so regardless of who is right, who is wrong, it seems like this strike is a reflection of that. I heard that the last time that, I think there are two unions, if I'm not mistaken, the last time that these same people went on strike, in this same way was when Ronald Reagan was the president of the Screen Actors Guild, which must have been a long time ago. I heard that being said by someone on the news, and I was flipping through the channels and they had the local news, which I always avoid because it's so tainted, but I don't know, I felt the need to listen to it, and it was enough. I listened to it for long enough to hear that, and it sounds like it's true. The reason why I'm mentioning this this strike is that Matt, in that segment that I was watching on this local news show, they showed Matt Damon. So someone interviewing Matt Damon and asking him what he thought about the strike, and he said I'm paraphrasing, but more, these are more or less the words that he used. He said, "Well, our leadership believes that these contracts are not fair, and therefore I stand with the leadership and I stand in support of all of us. We need to be united, blah blah blah." So, and the context of the question was, you know, what do the big stars who might not be affected as much by the strike think about it? In other words, the people who already have made it, who don't have to worry about, you know, living day to day and all that, what do they think about the strike? And that's when they showed us this clip of Matt Damon being asked the question. And when I heard it, you know, first of all, I have a very low image of Matt Damon. I think I've heard him say some very stupid things in the past. So he's a moron. And I think, I don't know if I'm wrong, but I think he might be of Irish descent. So the Celtic thing, betrayal thing, is kind of alive and kicking in him. Aside from that, and I might be mistaking him for somebody, or mixing him up in my head with someone else, but at least that's the impression I get. But when I heard him say those things, it just said, wow, that's so sad. He didn't say, the contract is unfair. I saw this in the contract, and this is not right because, you know, this is too little money, or the creative rights here are being violated, blah, blah, blah. He didn't go into any detail about the contract or give his personal opinion saying, I believe the contract is wrong. No, he said, the leadership believes the contract is wrong, and therefore I stand with the leadership in opposition to it. And that's exactly, you know, what false contracts are about, in an indirect relationship. So even if this interesting that here we're talking about, you know, they were talking about these contracts that are being offered, and the thing is that the point is that that's how false contract people live. They don't have a direct he didn't even have a connection with the contract he was opining about. He had a relationship with the leadership, which in turn had a relationship with the contract and made a decision on whether the contract was good or bad. And even though it also, I would dare say, affects him, you know, in a very significant way, because he's part of the industry, you would think he would be interested in knowing, okay, who's right, who's wrong here. But no, it doesn't matter. That's how false contract people live. It's a contract, they're contracts of indirect relationship with the priesthood, not the truth. The second thing we wanted to emphasize is that about the false contracts is that false contracts operate by external parameters because of their indirectness, and they do not require sacrifice from within. In other words, because they don't have a direct connection with the truth, there's no intimate knowledge with the truth, so it's all external. So the leadership, the priesthood, and just as a side note, I'm not saying that the Screen Actors Guild are a false contract priesthood. I have no idea what the contract, you know, what the issues are. I just wanted to illustrate the indirectness of how false contract people behave. And Matt Damon is a false contract person. He's a, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, unless I'm confusing him with someone else, he is a liberal and he has said some moronic things. But that's how false contract people thing. So even if these Screen Actors Guild, people are right in their arguing, you know, in their fighting, in their striking, the point is the indirectness. So the thing is, because the false contracts are based on indirectness, then it's all based on external parameters. They don't have a direct relationship with the truth. So it's just a list of external things. They fulfilled them and they're done. This is what you have to be to be compassionate. Check this. Then you earn the label of compassionate. But because you didn't become acquainted with compassion directly, then you have no idea, what true compassion is. So you have to rely on external parameters to get you to understand what compassion is, supposedly. Because it's all external, then there's no sacrifice from within. It's like this Matt Damon fellow, it does require a bit of sacrifice to kind of do the research and find out, okay, you know, what's this contract about? Because if these people are on strike and it's for the wrong reasons, if I were this big shot, I would want to, let them know and say, hey, I stand with you guys on this and this and this, but I think that you might want to reconsider your position on this and this and this because it might harm you in the long term, and I don't think it's fair for you to be demanding this or that. I don't think you should go on industrial action or whatever on this because I disagree with this, but it would have required him looking into the contracts and learning about them and what's being rejected. And that requires time and effort. It's a sacrifice. But false contract people never do that sacrifice from within. That's why when it comes to doing something that requires paying a price, they always shrug their shoulders, lift their hands in the air and say, I'm not touching that. That's what the indirectness causes. It's all external and there's no real sacrifice from within. The third thing I wanted to mention, and we did, mention it before, we just want to emphasize it again, is that these false contracts are covenants. They are almost like blood covenants. It's like you sign into it. You pledge your loyalty, your allegiance to this ideology, to this priesthood, to this elite club. And in return, the elite club grants you all these certificates. It's a covenant that you make, and these false contracts are nasty covenants. And by contrast, a true contract is one where you have a direct relationship with the truth. You're not making the contract with a priesthood. You're making a contract with, you're making an effort to make the contract with the truth directly. So you're making a covenant with the truth. And the fourth thing we wanted to emphasize, which we already said before, but I believe it's worth emphasizing, is that false contracts lead to oldness or staleness because there's the relationship with an ever-expanding truth. Truth is always growing. Yeah, just look at computers and computer technology or the sciences and all these things. Truth is always growing and going into new dimensions. It's not that the truth is growing. It's like our understanding of the truth keeps growing because there's so much to understand. You see what I'm saying? It's not that the truth is growing and evolving. The truth doesn't evolve. The truth is. But as you come to know the truth is, you realize that the truth is always growing and expanding and reaching new dimensions. And it's like going from one dimension to the next, to the next, to the next. Because the false contract detaches you from the truth, then it just becomes stagnant, because it's all, you know, all you have to worry about is this contract, this very, very simple, limited contract. And yes, the contract will change, as we said before, because they are very flexible. The priesthood readjusts them to fit their agenda. You know, you, for example, in the past, you to be a good liberal, you had to hate the drug companies because they were all evil and greedy and killing people for money. And now suddenly that they're doing it in such a blatant, direct way with the mRNA gene therapy injections, now suddenly the checklist you know, says you support Big Pharma. And if you support Big Pharma, then you are a good liberal and a good human being, and you have respect for other people, you know, all these things. So they vary. You know, for example, we did mention this, I think, but with the masking during the lockdown nonsense, they started to try to, because they realized that they didn't really have much science to support the masking. So, and it made no sense, like, oh, okay, you're saying that if I'm unmasked, I'm a danger to the masked. Which made no sense. You know, common sense is, well, no, if you're masked, then you're protected. If you're unmasked, it's like you're on your own, brother. And if you die of the virus, it's, you know, you, they could argue it's your fault because you didn't, you know, put the mask on. But no, and that's what common sense and logic would dictate. But they need, and they knew that, so they realized, oh, that we have a problem here. We need them to you know, because they were creating a scenario. They wanted to create an environment, and they needed the people to be masking up to promote the environment of fear and all this. So they said, well, we have to kind of switch it around. I said, oh no, if you don't wear a mask, you're showing disrespect to other people. And in other words, they tried to shame you into wearing it, because if you didn't wear it, you had no concern or regard or respect for the health or the well-being of other people. And that's how they try to convince you. So that was the check box. You show respect. If you want the label of respectful of other people, you have to wear a mask. But then ironically, now here, for example, in the New York, New Jersey area, cannabis smoking is legal. So people, you know, light up the joint in public places, even with children and around. Even I have even seen black people smoking marijuana, walking with their children out on the street. I mean, it's not been that many cases, but I've seen it, and I go, my goodness, this is so sad. But the thing is that, so these people are just, you know, unleashing the stench. And it's such a powerful stench. If you haven't experienced it, you know, you have no idea what I'm talking about. But if you have, I think you do. It is an overwhelming stench. You can be 80, 90 yards away, and it's just so powerful. It just fills entire areas, spaces. Even if you're outside and the wind is blowing, it's overwhelming, and it's a stench. It's horrible. And so these people are, and it's legal now, so you can't call the police, you can't do anything, just because the white fascist liberals have decided, you know, the check boxes. You are a cool human being if you're okay with people smoking cannabis in your presence, because cannabis is tied to another agenda. The agenda, you know, because black people have this problem with cannabis, and they were getting, you know, criminal records because of it. So they wanted to decriminalize it. So you know, to pander to black people. And also, you know, the more people smoking cannabis, the easier they are to manipulate, the lower their moral standards, the lower their ethical values and all that. It all fits their agenda. So now it's okay. But it's ironic, because if you're smoking, you see, the thing is, I'm of the type, I say to myself, you know, you're destroying your life by ingesting all that stuff. But if you really are that you know, desperate to you know, to do your addiction thing, why don't you buy some brownies, for crying out loud, and eat them? You know, I don't know. I don't think brownies smell. Maybe they smell if you sniff them up close, but I don't think that I would know that someone is eating a cannabis brownie 80 yards away from me. You know, because I don't think there's any sort of smoke emission that comes out of that. I don't know. Maybe they do light up as you chew them. I have no idea. But the thing is that why don't they do that? That would be a sign of respect. Like, okay, I'm in a public place with tens of people around me, or hundreds of people sometimes, like in Manhattan, in New York. And I'm going to show respect for them. I'm not going to contaminate and pollute their environment just because I want to get high in public. So I'm going to eat a brownie. See, that's what a person would do if they had a relationship with respect. Well, you know, if they had a relationship with the truth, they wouldn't be eating the brownie to begin with. But, you know, in the context of respect, they would at least say, well, I can't help it. I'm addicted. So but out of respect for these people, I'm going to ingest this cannabis in chewable form instead of puffable form. But see that but these very people who were so drastic and liberal and unyielding, because I, for example, I even got physically kicked by a white idiot one time for not wearing a mask near her, and then she started arguing with me why I wasn't wearing a mask, which kind of made no sense, because by forcing me to argue with her, I was forced to emit all my deadly, you know, viruses from my mouth to talk to her. But and she took off the mask to argue with me why I wasn't wearing the mask, and it's like, my goodness, you see what I'm saying? It makes no sense. If I'm such a deadly agent of death for not wearing the mask, she should be afraid of me and not even want to cause me to talk, because by me talking, I would be spreading more death particles, virus particles in the air or whatever. But the thing is that these same people who were so drastic about it have no problem whatsoever with people ruining other people's lives by smoking cannabis around them. So the respect thing is gone, because they don't understand what respect is, because they were told respect is to wear a mask. And that's what, oh, okay, I respect people, therefore I'm going to wear a mask. All these blatant ass acts of disrespect and the lack of consideration for other human beings, they're not a problem because they're not on the list, because the list is adjusted to agendas. So it's not connected to the truth. These labels are not true labels because they have no connection to the truth, really. They are just a label. That's all they are. And all of this... So yes, the contracts do fluctuate, but they stay in a very, very low dimension. They don't grow, they don't evolve in understanding. In if anything, if they do evolve, it's evolve into greater and greater degradation and decay. False contracts at best lead to oldness, to staleness, and in the worst of cases, they lead to outright degradation. So there's no growth. So that's why another term that we could use for the false contracts are old contracts. They're contracts of oldness. Whereas when you have a direct relationship with the truth, it's a new contract. It's a contract of newness, because you're interacting with the truth. And as you interact with the truth, you start growing into new and greater dimensions. And this topic of the newness is more or less related to the topic we wanted to cover in this audio snippet. And we haven't even gotten to it yet. But before we get to the topic, I did want to mention a couple of things. Kind of sad things. I was intending on mentioning a third thing that happened to me personally. A very sad thing that happened. I was almost physically attacked, but thankfully I was protected, and nothing happened. But I was almost attacked, and somebody threatened me with a stick and threw it at me and all that stuff. A crazy Hispanic. And I called the police. I chased the guy, but it was not a running chase. It was like a walking chase. I'd have to tell you the whole story, but I'm not going to go into it. I had to call the Hoboken police, which is incompetence personified. You know, I have one thing I can say about New York, bad as it is, the experience I've had with New York police has been very different. I know they are on a decline as well, but at least with them, I have seen a certain measure of professionalism and respect and competence that, my goodness, the Hoboken police has never shown. I've called on them several times about certain things that they always do nothing. They are incompetent, lazy and incompetent. And I wanted to mention that that story, but I'm not going to go into that. But it, in a sense, that incident and my, I had more, the police were more concerned about me, the victim, or the person being victimized, than about dealing with the Hispanic who tried to attack me for no reason at all. The guy was crazy. So because it's apparently I showed no compassion, or I should have just run away. That's what they were trying to convince me of, that I made the mistake of standing my ground when I was being assaulted, that I should have just run away like a little coward. That's what they wanted to tell me. And they were trying to convince me. And instead of going after the guy, they were, the guy just kept going. I knew where he was because I was following him. But the police, long story. I don't want to get into the details. But part of the interaction with this two stupid cops, and both were white this time. Usually I get Hispanics who are very, either very incompetent or very rude and arrogant. I think a lot of Puerto Ricans are in that police department, from what I can perceive. But this time I got two white guys and incompetence anyway. But in that exchange that I had with them, it's like that kind of lit up this thing about, oh yes, it's as if I was getting confirmation that, or this idea that, yes, you have to talk about this in the next audio snippet. But I'm not going to go into the details of what happened there because it's too, it's too many details and it's not even worth, but it just disappointed me even more about the country. You know, the country is gone. It is gone. When such a simple thing as a straightforward issue gets warped into something else, it is so sad. Well, the thing is, I do want to mention something else that really shocked me. It really, it froze me. I don't know how to explain it. It really shocked me to the core. That's how much it affected me. And you might, when I explain it to you, you might say, why? But I hope I can get my point across. And it was a story about legal immigrants being forced to take the mRNA gene therapy, you know, rape injection, you know, what I call RBIs, rapes by injection. And it was the story on this conservative website. And I was surprised to even see the headline because conservatives really don't care about legal immigrants. I've always had the sense that they really don't care. The immigration system is broken in the sense that it's very, very harsh, very tough, very, very, and the parameters for deciding who stays, who doesn't are very warped. They're not correct, and the people who want to do it the right way have to go through hell to become legal immigrants and eventually, residents or citizens or whatever. It is a very unfair system, and that kind of all in a certain sense. And I'm not saying it is, but it quote justifies. It seems to quote justify all these people who try to go around the system. But but that's not really a justification, because these people go around the system regardless. But what I'm trying to say is that some people who would want to do it the right way may opt out because it is such a bad system, and it needs to be corrected. So the right people who should be coming, who need to come, and who deserve the opportunity for us to honor what is said, that poem from the Statue of Liberty, give us your whatever, I forget what it says, but give us your week and whatever. For us to honor that, we need to change the system. And conservatives really don't care about this. I was shocked to see the headline. And this is the website run by this the Hoft brothers, Jim and Joe Hoft, and I think I've talked about them, and I've been very harsh about them because they are in many ways they mean well, but in other ways they're stubborn idiots. It's the gatewaypundit.com, the website. But when I saw the article, I said, did Jim or Joe Hoff write it? But no, it turned out to be somebody else. I'm sorry, I didn't remember the name. I think it was Peter something. A name I had never seen before on that website. And the guy goes into this long explanation of how Bite Me has removed a lot of mandates, the injection mandate from federal agencies and all that. He did that recently, and a big hoopla about that. But this writer was mentioning that for legal immigrants, it's still a requirement. So in other words, if you want to get a residency, if you want to get a green card, if you want to keep the process going, for your legal status in the country, you have to take the injection. Can you imagine the horror? Maybe you are here because you want to escape the culture that you were living in, the horrible third world culture you were living in. You want a new future. You want a new life, and you've paid all this money, made all this effort to make it into the country, to do everything the right way, the legal way, and now on top of it, they're saying you have to destroy your health in order to be an American or to be a legal resident of this country. Imagine the decision. It's like a horrible Sophie's Choice moment. Kind of, what do I do? Do I yield to this, or do I give up? It is evil. It broke my heart to know this. I did not know that. It really, really sent a chill down my spine to see that. I could share a lot of other things, but let me leave it at that. It just sent a chill down my spine to know that how evil these people are, and how what they're doing to legal immigrants now. And this writer was very, very eloquently talking about these things and pointing out how wrong it is, and how hypocritical. Because all these illegal aliens were flooding in through the border. They're not forced to take the injection to stay, and be released into the country. They don't have to take the injection. They're just let in and bust, further inland. And then, they're let go. No one takes an injection, forces them to get injected. So the illegal ones don't have to sacrifice their life, but the legal ones do. And that's what he was pointing out. And so I finished reading the article, I didn't read it, but I kind of browsed through it. And I finished it. I got down to the comments section. I said, I wonder if this is going to touch the heart of any reader out there. And it's like deep inside, I said, oh, they're probably not going to care. And I was expecting indifference, but I was hoping for someone, some conservative, to be touched in his heart about this and feel what I was feeling. Believe you me, I felt almost a chill going down my spine as I was reading this story. And what I found in the comment section, it just proved to me the country's dead. And the chill that I felt originally just became ice cold, you know, Antarctica cold. I said, oh my goodness, it just really, really shocked me, because the comments were basically, we should, instead of going into the, talking about the article, the comments were, well, for example, the very first comment at the top was something like, we should close everything, the country down for 50 years, not let anyone in for 50 years. Because we've had enough already, you know, we're full, thank you very much. And then everybody else agreeing with the guy, we should not be absorbing any more people, blah, 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 blah. We shut the country down for 50 years, and it really, you know, it's like, oh my goodness. So instead of feeling the empathy for, and then these people wonder why a lot of the immigrants vote Democrat. Because, you know, Democrats, they are like, you know, satanic, demonic, like Satan coming and tempting them with all these goodies and all this stuff. They really don't care about them. And, you know, but they, you know, they use them and manipulate them. But at least they hear like some sort of caring, and I say that in big quotes, from the Democrats. With Republicans, they hear nothing, and the few times they hear something, it's things like this. No wonder they flock to the Democrat Party. But the thing is that what it shocked me at so many levels, and it kind of proved to me the country is dead. This country is a worthless country now. And what bothered me and there were many things, but one of the key things that bothered me was the fact that it means that conservatives, the hardcore conservatives, don't understand that they needed help from the outside. They needed help from people who were outsiders in some ways. You know, people who were not trapped in the American way of thinking, who loved America, but were not trapped in the American way of thinking. People who thought differently, who had a different way of thinking. And I'm not saying, you know, introduce the type of foreign thinking that bastards like O'Bastard and other people were bringing in, you know, evil doctrines from the outside, anti-American evil doctrines. That's not what I'm talking about, but a different perspective, because this country remained incomplete and it needed something from the outside. And the truth provided that to this country. And the country said, we don't want it anyway. And by these people saying, you know, we should shut the country down for 50 years, like, we don't need anything from the outside. We're so wonderful, such a great nation, with a great foundation left by our priests, our high priests, the founding fathers. We don't need anything else from the outside. We were perfect, just as we were. It's a shame all this new stuff has come in that has messed things up. It's not a problem with the foundation. It's all this extra stuff that's come in. They don't realize the extra stuff has come in because of the shoddy foundation. And the people, and there was a need from the outside to come in and help rebuild the foundation and point out the flaws in the foundation. Outside thinking. And they didn't understand it. And that's why I know the country's dead. I did want to mention that. It was shocking to me. You have no idea how much it hit me hard when I read that story and I saw the reaction. You know, it shocked me on the one hand because of the callousness of Bite Me and how these, you know, these legal immigrants are being forced to choose between their life and you know, staying away from the third world they left behind. So evil. And then it shocked me to see what conservatives think. That, you know, the liberals doing this evil, and then the conservatives in their callous reaction, as if to say, we don't need anything else from the outside, when, no, the salvation was coming from the outside. You needed to be saved by outsiders. But no, you rejected them, and therefore you're dead, you worthless bitch. And that's what I'm saying to America right now, you worthless bitch. You didn't understand that the outsiders were your salvation, the people who had a thinking from the outside, and you said no. So, worthless bitch, you'll be dead in 2 or 3 months. The other thing I wanted to mention is something that happened a few hours before this recording, yesterday. Late yesterday, I think it might have been 7 or 8 p.m., but because it's summertime, you know, the sun was still up, so it was still daylight, you could say. And I was working, and I always work in front of the window, in the flat where I live. And suddenly, I think I sat down for a second. I'm always standing up, but I was tired. I sat down for a second. And then suddenly I heard some sort of crash. Something happened on the street, and I have the window open. So I heard it. So I stood up and tried to look around, and then I looked down, and directly in front of me, like it was all set up to happen in front of me. What had happened was that a guy, a car was coming, and I'm near the intersection. I'm not in the corner, but I am like maybe one or two houses away from the corner, from the intersection. But this car kind of stopped before getting to the intersection, apparently to let someone off. And I found that, I don't know, I think he might have stopped also because there was a car in front of him. I didn't notice. I'm not too sure. But the thing is, they stopped right in front of me, and somebody got off the car. And as they opened the car door on the right side, a lady was coming with those e-scooter thingies that people use sometimes now. And she was coming up the street on the e-scooter on the right side of the car. So when the passenger came out, because here in America, the passenger comes out of the right side. So when he came out of the right side, and I think he was coming out the back, I don't remember. But the thing is, he came out the right side, he opened the door, and he didn't see the lady with the e-scooter coming, and the lady hit the door. But it was very loud. It was like, pah! And but I didn't see the crash. I just saw the aftermath. So I looked down, and directly in front of me, the whole thing, that's when I saw what had happened. And then the lady, because I could hear everything, I had the window open, and all it was happening in front of me. And the lady said to him, "Hey, you should have looked before opening the door." And then he said, I heard you," or something like that. I couldn't quite make out what he said, but clearly in the tone. And by the way, the guy was a tall white guy, Anglo-Saxon, not a Hispanic, not a black guy. And the lady who on the scooter was a white lady, older, not a young little girl, but maybe in her 50s. I don't know. I shouldn't be guessing ladies' ages, because you always get in trouble with that. But she was a white lady. So it was the exchange between two white people. And it was weird, because I would have never expected to see such an exchange between two white people. I think it might be the first time in my life. And I wasn't born yesterday. I've been around, unfortunately, for quite a while. And it's, I think, the first time in my life that I've ever seen two white people have an exchange like that. I had never seen it in my whole life. Believe me, I had never seen it. Maybe, I've seen it in films, on television or whatever, but never in person. And if you had, described the incident to me, I would have said, "Oh, yeah, I'm sure the guy coming out of the car was a Hispanic. because that usual or yeah, I would I wouldn't have said black, maybe. I would have said Hispanic, because that's the behavior that I've seen with them. You know, they don't give a damn. I see that it constantly. When I'm walking on the street, when they're walking as a family, they all stretch out to fill out the entire pavement or sidewalk, like they were an army, you know, and this front of soldiers, instead of, you know, worrying about other people. And so you have to kind of get around them, and as you're trying to get around them, they try to cut you off, as if to say, "How dare you get around me?" It is so weird, very weird, a very, you know, very odd behavior. So I would have guessed that this whole, if you had asked me, this whole incident would have been with a Hispanic and a white person, or two Hispanics, or whatever. But it was two white people, and what happened was the guy got off, you know, after the boom, the hit. So that's when I looked down, and the lady, the e-scooter kind of like was a little shaken and started backing off to let the passenger get off. When he got off, she said to him, "Oh, you should wash before opening the door like that." And he said something like, "I heard you," or whatever, or something like that. But I don't know the words, but I didn't hear, you know what happened, well, what I would have expected usually with white people is, "Oh, I'm really sorry. Oh, I didn't see you. Are you okay? I apologize. I'm really, really sorry. I didn't mean to hurt you. I hope you're fine," or whatever. And I would have apologized to the car driver, you say, "Sorry, you know, because, you know, I could have, your door could have been damaged," you know. And even if, I really don't know who's right, who's wrong there, to be frank. I don't know if the e-scooter lady was wrong. I don't know. It's difficult to say. But if I had been the person getting off the car, my reaction would have been, "I'm sorry, are you okay?" That would have been, that's what I would have expected and what I would have seen most of the time from white people. But in this case, it was a tall white guy, clearly as white as you can make him. So it was not like a white Hispanic or something, you know, white Anglo-Saxon. You ship him off to Germany and he would fit right in. He would be part of the national wrestling team or whatever. So the thing is that, the lady was, you know, but the lady wasn't satisfied with the, you know, so-so answer that he gave. Because he just, okay, whatever, and started walking away. And the lady said, "You should have looked." Like, as if to say, "Hey, I demand a human reaction from you instead of this animal idiot reaction." She didn't say it like that, but, you know, she repeated the statement as if to say, "Hey, you should react like a human being. You just did something. You almost got me hurt." And the guy said, "I heard you the first time, but this time I heard it, and he was loud and angry." And then she said, "No, you should have looked." And then the guy said, and then the guy started screaming real loud, the white guy. And I couldn't see him because he was below me, you know, on a part of the street I couldn't see because he was directly below. And the lady on the scooter just, you know, kept going. As she kept going on the scooter, she started screaming back, and she called him something I can't say in this recording. I was siding with the lady because the guy kept screaming at her like, "I heard you," and blah blah blah, and screaming at her, never apologized, and tried to humiliate her, you know, very loudly in public. So she kind of responded, "You're an idiot," but she used another word. And then some more shouting happened and she left. And I said, "Oh my goodness, the country is dead. The country is dead." And this was an exchange between two white people. And I don't blame the lady for reacting like that. I wouldn't have used the word she used, but in fact, if it had happened to me, I would have stayed there. She went away. I would have stayed there and confronted the guy, just like I did with the crazy Hispanic who tried to attack me. literally, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, he tried to attack me, and then he went to get a stick and was coming at me with the stick. And I stood my ground. The thing is, I wouldn't have backed. And then when I threatened to call the police, that's when he got scared and started walking away, and I started following him as I was calling 911, or, you know, the equivalent of 999 here. So I was on the phone, and while I was on the phone, a guy walked, a guy on a bike, came up to me, next to me, you know, on the street. I was on the pavement, on the sidewalk, and he said, and I was talking to the 911 lady, and I didn't even look at him, but I felt him, and I heard him, and he said, oh, he's homeless. And I know, I've seen that guy before around here. I've lived in Hoboken 8 or 9 years, so I've seen that son of a bitch before. I know him. I know about him. I know the demons that operate in him. He has two demons in him. Long story. The thing is that, and I didn't even turn around to talk to the guy. I said, oh my goodness. You know, so this guy was more concerned about the guy who just almost attacked me and physically assaulted me. And I had to show compassion. I just felt like turning around and saying, oh, thank you for this enlightening piece of information that you just shared with me. Oh, that changes everything. Oh, he was homeless. Oh my goodness, I should have let him hit me. Oh my goodness, how could I have ever shouted back at him and confronted him for his aggression towards me? Oh, he was homeless. I had to show compassion and mercy. Because, you know, because this guy was living under a false contract where, you know, if a person is homeless, then you bend over backwards to let them do whatever the hell they want, because that's what it means to be compassionate. See what I'm saying? And then I almost got a similar lecture from the police guy. And the police guy knew about this guy and knew that this guy was El Wacko. He knew him. And he still, I was still the problem. And I could say, hey, can't you go after him? Can't you go after him? I know where he is. He's like 2 blocks from here. And instead, no, I was the focal point. And as I was following him, he was shouting and threatening other people. And he knew that I was following him, so he was shouting at me. But I kept following him, and he kept running away. Long story. The thing is, I'm getting sidetracked. The thing is that if I had been the lady on the e-scooter, I would have shouted at him, and I would have cursed him out. Not with cuss words, but cursing him literally. And I would have told the son of a bitch to get the hell out of my country. If you're not going to behave like an American, you white, and I would have said, you white fascist liberal son of a bitch, get the hell out of my country. That's what I would have said to him. And I know that I would have said to him, he would have come at me and there might have been violence. But I said, there's no backing down. Like, okay, you are worthless rubbish. You get the hell out of my country. You don't belong in my land. You don't belong in this in my territory if you're not going to behave like a first world citizen, respectful of other people. But it was sad to see this incident, the e-scooter incident. That's what I call it. And if you had told me the story without telling me the names of the people involved, I would have said, oh, the guy who got off the car was a Hispanic for sure. But no, he was an angry white guy. And self-righteous about what he did. Like, I don't care, and you're not going to tell me that I did something wrong. And that's more or less what where conservatism is right now. So that's where the country is, and it was very, very... And it happened right in front of me. It's as if the truth set it up so that I could see it, so that I would mention this in this recording. This is where the country is right now. It's very sad. And before we finally get to the topic that we wanted to mention, I did want to say one more thing. Wow, it's been an hour and I haven't gotten to the topic. I do want to say that, having said all of this about America, I still have some concern about England too. And the reason is that I want to say that I'm saying this is, I saw this headline. I'm going to read the headline, not go into the article. But the headline said, trans activist who served 30 years in jail for attempted murder and told London crowd, quote, if you see a TERF, punch them in the face. unquote, arrested for, quote, incitement to violence, unquote, video. So, in other words, they had a video along with the story. And I had heard about this. There's some crazy guy in England. They call him a she. It's a he. I know that in some places that is, what do they call it? Discrimination or violation of rights or whatever. But the guy is a he. So I'm not going to call him a she just because he wants to be a she. You know, if he wants to be a cat, should I say Fluffy? You know, what should I, call him Fluffy or Garfield? You know, no, it's a he, you know, wearing women's clothing, trying to be a woman or thinking he's a woman. But the thing is that this guy, who served 30 years in jail for attempted murder, So he said on some post or something, and I saw that if you see a TERF, punch them in the face. And TERF means something about trans, I forget. But it's, you know, it's the feminist, the term they've used for the feminists like J.K. Rowling, who are opposed to you know, the all these transsexual men infiltrating women's sports and things like that. And right now, like Miss Netherlands, Mr. Netherlands, Miss Netherlands is actually a Mr., the one who got nominated, whatever it's called, for the Miss Universe contest in the Netherlands is a guy. I mean, so these men are encroaching on these areas of women, and there are some feminists who were not happy about it, so, and they're calling them TERFs. So if you see a TERF, punch them in the face. So that's what the guy was saying. But the thing is, he was arrested for saying that, and he was arrested for incitement to violence. Now, this is ironic, because I would, on the one hand, I would be vilified as hate speech for calling him a he. But on the other hand, I'm going to say something, and I hope you understand the context of what I'm saying, why I'm saying this. It shocked me to know that he was arrested, and it bothered me deeply that he was arrested for, quote, incitement to violence. I could be wrong on this, so please do have some compassion, quote unquote, for me if I'm wrong on this. But I do believe that he should not have been arrested for that. And you would say, well, he's calling for people to act out in violence. But the problem is, first of all, if you say it figuratively and people don't get it that you were saying it figuratively, then, are you going to put me in jail too for that? If you say the same thing about a Christian, would they do the same thing? I'm not sure. I really don't think so. But the thing is that it is dangerous when, if you say something, then suddenly you're going to be arrested for it. Because it's the problem that England has, that there really is no freedom of speech. And it's, if I am allowed to leave this country and not die in this hellhole of called America, and I am able to leave and live in England, I'm going to be an outsider coming with an idea, and I'm going to cause trouble with that. That I'm going to say, people of England, you need to embrace a concept from the New World, from America, called freedom of speech. And it I see myself standing on the Westminster Bridge, and I've been there once, well, several times. The thing is that I see myself, if I ever get to England, standing on the Westminster Bridge, saying out loud, you know, because on that bridge you can see Parliament, right, you know, to your left, depending on how you're standing, but kind of, I see myself with the parliament to my left, and saying real loud to the people as they're walking on the bridge, saying Britain needs to have freedom of speech, and the parliament, and I'd be pointing to the parliament, needs to change the laws of this country to allow its citizens and its people to speak freely. And I don't know if I would get arrested for doing that, but that's what I see myself doing. And that's something England needs desperately, and it's very troubling. So just as I'm concerned about America, that one thing does concern me deeply about England. And the reason why I'm upset is also because there was this story. And by the way, in the comment section of this headline, I went to read the comment section to see what people thought, and I said, are people going to be upset that England has no freedom of speech? And no, everybody was, oh yeah, they should jail that guy, that trans crazy fellow, and he has mental problems, and yeah, he's a murderer, he served 30 years in prison, and all this blah blah blah. And yeah, good riddance. They should have a good thing. They arrested him, blah, blah, blah. And I went, oh my goodness, this is so weird. Because, and you know why? Because a few, not too long ago, I forget, I think it was around June 8th. And at the start of June, if I'm not mistaken, there was another story, about, a guy in England who was arrested over a t-shirt. And I'm going to read you the story from the BBC. Unfortunately, that's where I had to go to read this, to find the story again. It says, man arrested at Wembley over 97 football shirt. It says, a man has been arrested during the FA Cup final at Wembley after concerns about a football shirt slogan. This is a story from the 4th of June, so it was from that, around that time. It says, a photo of the back of a man wearing the number 97 and the words not enough on a Manchester United top was widely shared on social media. The FA said it strongly condemned the action, which it said referred to the 1989 Hillsborough disaster when 97 Liverpool fans died as a result of a stadium crush in 1989. It said it would not, quote, tolerate abuse. The Metropolitan Police tweeted that a man had been arrested on suspicion of a public order offense and taken into custody. The force confirmed to the BBC that the arrest was solely due to the shirt worn by the football fan, but would not confirm that it was because of his alleged reference to Hillsborough. So, first of all, the shirt only said 97 is not enough. Well, you could argue, well, doesn't say Hillsborough disaster, so how do you know? I guess we can all kind of guess that it was related to the Hillsborough disaster, but we start going into very dangerous territory when you arrest someone over a t-shirt. So, if, you know, it's like saying in America, for example, I know it's not equivalent, but, bite me can go to hell, or bite me should go to hell, and right now, you know, they could go, oh, okay, is he saying he wants the president dead? You know, he's not the president, but that's what these stupid idiots would say. Oh, he's threatening the president of the United States, so we'll put him in jail. You know, that sort of thing. And just so you know, the Hillsborough disaster, I'm going to read from the Wikipedia article on it, was a fatal human crush during a football match at Hillsborough Stadium in Sheffield, South Yorkshire, on the 15th of April, 1989. And 15th of April, that's tax day in the U.S., it occurred during an FA Cup semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest. In the two standing only central pens in the Leppings Lane stand allocated to Liverpool supporters. Shortly before kickoff, in an attempt to ease overcrowding outside the entrance turnstiles, the police match commander David Duckenfield ordered exit gate C to be opened, leading to an influx of supporters entering the pens. This resulted in overcrowding of those pens and the crush, with 97 deaths and 766 injuries. It has the highest death toll in British sporting history. 94 people died on the day, another person died in hospital days later, and another victim died in 1993. in other words, like 4 years later. But apparently this person who died, it says here, in July 2021, a current coroner ruled that Andrew Devine, who died 32 years later, after suffering severe and irreversible brain damage on the day, was the 97th victim. So someone who was a victim of the incident died in 2021, in July 2021, which is 2 years ago to the day of this recording. And that was 32 years since the disaster. But he suffered severe and irreversible brain damage from that day. He was considered the 97th victim. So the t-shirt was basically saying 97 is not enough. So it's kind of a pot shot at Liverpool, I guess. And yes, I understand it's an offensive shirt. I don't defend it. That's not what I'm saying. But my concern is, now you're arresting people over a t-shirt. So that's why, that's the reason why my reaction, the reason for my reaction to this trans activist being arrested. Because if it was, you know, just the trans activist, you could kind of argue, yeah, he's inciting people to violence. Yeah, I understand. I kind of get it. But I know that he could have worn a t-shirt that said, you know, something that insinuates violence. It doesn't even say it. It's just you have to read between the lines and think about it and maybe assume that he's inciting violence. But and even then he would have been arrested. And that is problematic. There's something wrong with a country that arrests people over a t-shirt that says 97 is not enough. Really, it is problematic. And that has to be dealt with in England pronto. And if I do make it, I don't know if I will make it, but if I do make it out of here and make it to England, they will have to hear from an outsider about that. Because we have a better history about freedom of speech in America than in England. And now that America's dying, some of the precious things about America will be taken by the people who sought the truth and taken elsewhere. And I think that I'm going to be one of the ones carrying one of those things to England if I make it there. If they let me in, I might be too much of a problem. I don't know. So now, finally, we're going to get to the topic that we wanted to share. We have little time left, but it's related to the false contracts, but it's a slightly different thing. And it's a very simple concept. But the thing is, false contracts lead to a disconnect with the truth, as we were saying before. And that disconnect, grows and grows to the point that even basic truths are lost. In other words, you're so disconnected from the truth because you're relying so much on the priesthood that it gets to the point that the priesthood starts, you know, telling you to drink the Kool-Aid, and you start drinking it even if you know it's poisoned. And you see you see them preparing the Kool-Aid, and you see the arsenic bottle, and it says arsenic, you know, with the skull and the crossbones or whatever. Right in, on the label, you know, highly visible, and you see the guy pouring the arsenic into the Kool-Aid and then, you know, mixing it and then handing it to you and to everybody else and say, drink it, drink it, drink it. And you see that they're putting poison into the Kool-Aid, but you go, no, he must have some sort of chemical reaction with some other component in the Kool-Aid that neutralizes the poison and actually turns the poison into a beneficial agent for my health. Yeah, that's how false contract people think, because it becomes so disconnected from the truth that they don't even trust what their own eyes are seeing, and they, you know, he's seeing how the Kool-Aid's being done. It says water, some Kool-Aid, and then the arsenic, but there's nothing else being put in there, but he starts conjecturing and adding all these things. And starts justifying whatever the elite are doing. So it is the disconnect from the truth, because it's such an intermediary relationship. This disconnect is so great. Then even basic truths are lost. You know, you put poison on the arsenic in the Kool-Aid, then the Kool-Aid is dangerous. That's a basic reality, common sense. And that's what we want to talk about, common sense. That's how common sense is lost. So false contracts lead to a disconnect. As they start degrading, lead to a fundamental disconnect with common sense. And just to give you an example, and we kind of talked about this a little bit with the Basques during the time of the lockdowns. I remember there was a time that, they didn't let you eat inside the, you know, a restaurant or a diner or whatever. So you would go in and you were supposed to wear a mask. I never wore one. And I am so grateful that I survived that period. It's a miracle that I survived. I might have had to starve to death or whatever, but I didn't, because I always was given a door of mercy to survive the whole thing. But the thing is that I remember that you were supposed to go into the place, you know, all masked up and just leave. And then as time went on, they started kind of, because, you know, they knew that people were going to get very irritated by that if they kept it up too often, too much. So they became a little more lenient. Then they said, okay, you can go into the restaurant. You have to be masked up when you're at the cash register, like, or ordering your food. But then once you take your tray or food or whatever and go sit down, you can take off your mask and be maskless and eat maskless inside the restaurant or the food place. So you would see all these people who would come in and order and be all masked up. And then they would go and sit, and the table would be like right there next to the cash register or whatever. But magically, when they got to the table and sat down, they could take off the mask and they could breathe and eat and sit there and whatever. And I said to myself, well, common sense tells you that if this virus is so dangerous and destructive, how can it magically become non-destructive when you sit down to eat? It's indoors. You're still inside, and the tables are right there, and the air is trapped in here, and you're not. If it's so dangerous, it's going to get to me. Why is the virus dangerous when I'm near the cash register ordering my food, but not dangerous when I'm sitting down to eat it? You see what I'm saying? It just made no sense. I mean, if it's dangerous, it's dangerous. If it's not, it's not. Kind of like what I wanted to say, didn't get to say to the cops who were so stupid, the Hoboken cops in the incident I had. It's like, if the guy is dangerous, and you're telling me that I should have backed down and run away, if he's that dangerous that you need to tell me this over and over again, why aren't you going after him? If he's that dangerous. But if he's not dangerous, then why are you lecturing me on how dangerous it was to stand up to him if you know he wasn't dangerous? You see what I'm saying? Like, either he was or he wasn't. So at least be consistent about it. The thing is, and the same thing was with the masks. Well, either the virus is dangerous or it isn't. If it's dangerous, then no one should be able to, you shouldn't be able to sit down and eat and have. Why is the virus magically, you know, innocuous when you sit down to eat, but when you're a few feet, you know, at the cash register, suddenly it's a deadly agent. And the same thing with the issue of respect, you know, that that we said a moment ago. You show respect by wearing a mask, but you have no issues with disrespect if you smoke a joint and contaminate the environment for everybody around you within an 80, 90 yard radius. Even if they're children playing around or whatever, that's no disrespect. So you can pollute the air with a very blatantly present, contaminant. But this invisible contaminant that that was not as dangerous as they claimed it to be, that, you know, there you're showing disrespect if you don't wear the mask. And again, the irony, why am I putting the mask people in danger? Aren't they the ones protected? I'm the one who's not protected. Why am I, if the mask is, if it really works, why are you worried that I might infect them with my unmasked, breathing? Then you're telling me the mask doesn't work by saying that, oh, and now it's a question of respect. It's not a question of science. It's a question of social respect. So you're shifting the dialogue now to social respect instead of science. See, if you're if you have a relationship with the truth, a basic relationship with the truth, with no intermediaries, then you remain in common sense. So you start asking these questions, and you question the contract, but people who live by false contracts lose. They have a disconnect with common sense, because they don't have a direct relationship with the truth. Another example was the mRNA injections. Again, the same thing. You were supposed to get injected because you're supposed to be you are evil, and you're spreading the virus and putting us all in danger. That's what the injected were saying. You, the non-injected, are endangering us, the injected, by your selfishness of not getting the injection. And I go, well, okay, you're injected, right? So that's a shield of protection. It's safe and effective and all that other rubbish that you keep preaching to me about. Well, if you're protected, then you should say the hell with, you know, you should say, oh, this is Darwin, the evolution thing in effect, the stupid people die, killing each other, killing themselves off because they don't want to take the injection. So they are dying because they're stupid, and then we're cleansing the population from these idiots. You should be happy. But no, somehow I, who am not injected, am a danger to the one who is injected and protected. Well, if your injection works, why are you worried that I'm not injected? Why am I in danger to you? Shouldn't I be the one in danger because I'm not shielded by this wonderful umbrella of gene therapy, myocarditis protection that you're offering me? So it is common sense, the disconnect with common sense, like things that just make no sense at all. And then people take the injection, the vaccine, quote unquote, and they still get sick, and very sick of the virus, and they say, oh yeah, but the vaccine thank goodness I took the injection because it would have been worse without it, and you go, well, how are you calling it a vaccine? A vaccine is the idea of a vaccine is it prevents the infection. This is not only doesn't even prevent the infection, it doesn't even prevent the oncoming symptoms and radical symptoms many times. You go, well, then it's not a vaccine. Obviously, if you can take the vaccine and still get sick of the virus and very sick of it, then it's not a vaccine. That's what common sense would say. But the disconnect, again, between common sense and people who live by false contracts. That's why to them it's not a contradiction. But what I wanted to get to, and I'm finally getting to it, is that common sense, and this is the problem the conservatives have. Common sense can become a sandpit for those who escape from false contracts. You say what? It's like quicksand. Like, you're escaping from false contracts and you're going into the land of common sense, and you live in common sense, and it's a glorious place to live in. I'm living by common sense. I'm thinking, I'm being logical, I'm seeing reality for what it is, and you're excited about it. But there's a, there's, if you stay in common sense land for too long, it's like quicksand. It just starts sinking and sinking, and you get stuck, and you can't go anywhere, and you don't realize it. Yes, you're free from the false contract, but you've fallen into something else. And what happens is common sense, if you stay in common sense, you see, common sense has a place and a role to play. You know, there's some basic truths, basic things you can see and go, okay, yeah, X leads to Y leads to Z, hence X leads to Z. There's some, you know, very simple, basic, logical things you can see. And common sense, you know, works perfectly there. And it guides you and helps you to know what's right, what's not right, and so forth. But the problem is common sense tends to become trapped in external appearances. It's as if the contract, it's like you start developing a contract of your own with common sense instead of the truth. If you see what I'm saying, I hope I'm making sense. So you initially start with a relationship with the truth. You become acquainted with common sense and basic common sense, basic truths. It's like you get acquainted with the basics, and the basics help to break all these falsehoods, all these illusions and delusions that are being presented to you. And we talk about this in one of the postings on the website where these recordings are posted. We talk about escaping, these false revelations. And we talk about two things you need to do. You need to apply milk to it, which means apply basic doctrine, basic understanding to it, you know, like baby stuff, simple concepts. And then you have to apply a covering to it. There are two things you have to do to break false revelation, to uncover or dismantle false revelations in your heart and mind and in the hearts of others. But the thing is, you can't be drinking milk and be living by basic truths and basic concepts all your life. Eventually, you have to start eating solid meat. You have to grow. And the problem is common sense becomes this pit where you become eternally a child. So you're a child. You're understanding basic things. You don't follow the Kool-Aid people and all that. But you slowly become, you can become trapped in it, and it becomes, you start having a contract, not with the truth, but with common sense. So you start signing a covenant or a contract with common sense. And common sense then starts getting you to think only by external appearances. And the bad thing is that as you continue with that contract with common sense, it eventually degrades into a contract with individuals and institutions. So you start, you know, believing in common sense, not the truth. See, common sense is like a starting portion. I don't know, for lack of a better expression, a starting subset of the truth. So you start having a relationship with the truth, and you get acquainted with the basics. You don't get hit with, you know, deep, complex stuff. You start, you know, like with a baby, you start with simple things. You learn your alphabet, you learn to your basic arithmetic, your multiplication table and all that. But the thing is that if you start having a relationship with that subset of the truth only, then eventually, even though you started with a relationship direct with the truth, because you got stuck in that one subset of the truth, then eventually that contract degrades into a contract with individuals and institutions who you see what happens is then certain individuals start rising up and certain institutions, you know, the Heritage Foundation, I had to mention them by name, and some other institution, they start rising up and they take this common sense and they turn it into a mantra. And they say, okay, common sense says this, you know, Second Amendment rights, and blah, 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 and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. So I'm just showing an example of this institution thing. So people take this common sense and they take it and they turn it into a mantra, and they become a temple. The institution becomes a temple, and the priests who run the institution, who uphold this mantra that people have accepted, become the priests. And then you start having a contract with the Heritage Foundation. I'm just mentioning them by as an example. Or the Hillsdale College, or whatever. So you start having a relationship with these people who reinforce the same mantra over and over and over again. And then you start associating it with personalities. You know, certain people seem to uphold the common sense mantra. And then you had escaped from false contracts, you know, where you have an indirect relationship with the truth, and you end up kind of falling into the same pit, you know, pit again. But it's morphed, if you catch my drift. So you start with a relationship only with common sense, and eventually that degrades into a relationship with all the institutions that take that common sense and turn it into a religion, a mantra. And so then you become you start having a false contract with common sense. And then your growth stops. And just to give you an idea of what we're trying to mention here, and time is running out. It took me so long to get here. But for example, let's think about the theory of relativity, you know, that Einstein came up with at the start of the 20th century. And basically, one of the things that, you know, he talks about is how time is relative. And he kind of, scientists began to realize that somehow light always traveled at the same speed, no matter what. And it's so strange, because you would think, for example, let's say that the, you know, light is like a train, like a light beam is like a train, and you're sitting on the light beam. So you're traveling with the light, so you're traveling at the speed of light, because the train is, you know, traveling at that speed. You would think that if you're inside the train, let's say the light beam is a train, you're inside a train car, and you start walking forward in the direction of the train, that the train is going, then your speed, if I see you, like, let me put it to you this way. Let's say that I'm jogging inside the train, like I'm doing the 100-yard dash inside the train, and the train is going 60 miles an hour. If I am Jesse Owens or Usain Bolt, I'd be running the 100 meters in less than 10 seconds, which I think is the equivalent of 36 kilometers per hour, which might be 20 miles an hour or so. Let's say 20 miles an hour. So if the train's going at 60 miles an hour and I'm running 20 miles an hour inside the train, then if I am an outsider looking at you running inside the train, I would see you moving at 80 miles an hour, because, you know, you're inside the train, so you're already moving at 60. And inside the train, you're running at 20 miles an hour. So I hope I'm doing my numbers right. Let's assume 20 miles an hour is how fast Usain Bolt would run. Let's see. So that means that I would see you moving at 80 miles an hour. You're moving faster than the train, because you have the velocity of the train plus your own velocity. But the weird thing is, with light, it's not the same thing. If the train were traveling at the speed of light, and I saw you running like Usain Bolt or Jesse Owens inside the train, your speed, from my perspective, would not be the speed of light plus 20 miles an hour. It would still be the speed of light. And you could be running at half the speed of light inside the train, and I'll still see you running at the speed of light. You see what I'm saying? And they've discovered this principle. And then Einstein took that idea, and he said, okay, this is an undeniable truth, so I'm not going to argue with it. It makes no sense. See, that's where common sense breaks down, because that makes no sense to the common sense. That doesn't make sense. I mean, even as I'm explaining it, it doesn't make sense, but that's the reality. That's the physical reality. Now, if I live by common sense, what I do is I reject, oh, that's a bunch of hogwash. Those scientists don't know what they're talking about. No, but it is the reality. It is what it is. So Einstein said, I'm not going to reject it. I'm going to play with it. I'm going to say, okay, now that I am assuming this is true, what are the consequences? How can I make this make sense? And then what he did is, this makes sense if time changes as you travel faster and closer to the speed of light. And once he did that paradigm shift, boom, things started, you know, ticking and clicking. And then he proved that as you go faster, like if you're on a spaceship that's traveling at half the speed of light, the time for you inside the spaceship goes much slower than how it's going outside. So if you like take a space rocket and travel at let's say 90% of the speed of light around the universe and then come back like 10 years later, for you it was 10 years, but maybe here on Earth it would have been, I'd have to do the exact number, I'm sorry, but there's a formula for that. Instead of 10 years on Earth, it would have been 15 years that you were gone. But in your watch, in your calendar, you were gone for 10 years. But on Earth, it was as if you had left for 15 years because time changed. And that's the theory of relativity. And they have been able to do experiments to prove that is the case. It's not hogwash. It is what it is. And the only so there's a constant in the universe is the speed of light. Nothing can go beyond the speed of light. And I've always believed that the speed of light is the barrier between the temporal and the eternal. Once you cross that speed, you go into another realm. But inside this realm, that's the barrier. You can't go faster than the speed of light. Time stops. When you go, literally, according to Einstein, time stops once you get to the speed of light. And that's when, and if time stops, then the temporal has stopped. And then you go, if you're not in the temporal, you're hence in the eternal. So that's the barrier between the temporal and the eternal. It's the speed of light. And why am I saying all this stuff? I'm talking about the theory of relativity, something that is counterintuitive. In other words, it fights your common sense. It fights your current paradigms, your current understanding. So if you live in the land of common sense, if you've established a false contract with common sense, you will never grow into a new dimension of understanding about things. And that's common sense prevents you from understanding things like the theory of relativity. So it becomes a sand pit, a sand trap, where you become stuck in a very limited dimension of understanding. For example, think about the movement of the Earth and the planets. You know, people say, no, the Earth is not moving because I don't feel it move. You know, if the Earth was really moving, I would feel the shaking. That's what common sense told people. But it turns out, well, the Earth is moving, and it's moving in space. And they would try to map out all the heavenly bodies, how they moved. It was a complex, all these complex calculations, because they always started from the assumption the Earth does not move. Everything else moves, but the Earth. And that led to very complicated trajectories. But then Copernicus said, no, the sun is in the middle. And the Earth rotates around the sun, and all the other planets rotate around the sun, and the stars. And then suddenly, the movement of the planets became very easy to calculate once you change the paradigm. But at that time, common sense said, no, what are you, a moron? You're saying the Earth does not move, that the Earth is moving? Are you shaking? Do you feel the... You know, like when you're on a horse, because they didn't have cars at the time. When you're on a horse, you feel the horse moving, don't you? Do you feel the Earth moving, you stupid idiot? You know, let's burn you at the stake because you're a moron. So common sense can trap you from going to different understandings. Like another example, the Laffer curve that we've talked about before. The Laffer curve says that there is an effect of increased government tax revenue if you lower taxes. And that doesn't make any sense. It's like you go, oh, if you want the government to have more money for all these social programs, that's how Democrats think because they're idiots. So they go, okay, we need more money. We need to take more money from the people for all these social programs. So let's tax more people. Let's tax the rich. And let's add all these taxes to stifle the economy and get all this money so that we can do all these social programs. And they don't realize that by doing that, they stifle the economy and they end up with less money, less revenue for their social programs. And it's because of the Laffer curve, and we won't go into that because it'd be too long, but suffice, and it's a reality. You know, Ronald Reagan lowered taxes, he doubled government revenue. People always say, oh, he increased the deficit. No, the runaway spending increased the deficit. His lowering of taxes did not cause the deficit. His lowering of taxes actually doubled government revenue. That's a fact. It's not Kool-Aid stuff. That's reality, economic reality. He lowered taxes and government revenue, tax revenue, doubled. But that's counterintuitive. You say that to somebody, especially if they're a liberal moron, a white fascist liberal moron, they don't understand that because, you know, they have a false contract and their priests are telling them one thing. So, you know, it's like talking to an animal, talking to a monkey. And even if you're talking to a normal human being, you know, not a white fascist liberal, if you're talking to a normal human being, it still doesn't make sense. You know, how can you increase revenue by lowering the tax rate? Obviously, there's a point where, you know, tax rate is zero, you have no tax revenue. So obviously, there's a point where, yeah, if you lower taxes too much, then the revenue will go down, obviously. But generally, taxes are too high. As you start lowering them, the tax revenue will increase because you create economic activity. The economic activity creates more income. More income means more tax payments, and more tax payments mean more revenue. But the thing is that it's counterintuitive. But if you live in the land of common sense, you won't embrace that concept because that concept is going into a new dimension of understanding that the CSP, the common sense people, will not achieve, cannot attain to, because it requires you going up a level. See, common sense gets you out of the pit of the false contracts. It's like, you know, if you take the Bible, if you're a conservative Christian, think about the story in your Bible that talks about the Jews being brought out of Egypt. Well, it's like common sense gets you out of Egypt and into the wilderness. But then if you stay in common sense, you're going to wander in the desert and die. You have to go beyond common sense and go into a new dimension. That's when you cross the Jordan and enter into the promised land. So common sense can become a sand trap, literally, as it was for the Israelites who perished in the wilderness, according to the Bible. So the thing is that another example is Adam Smith's Invisible Hand. And I might be misquoting this, but from what I understand, Adam Smith, the economist, I think in 1776, he published a book, The Wealth of Nations, I think. 1776, I think, you know, the year that America was born. And I might be all wrong about this, but don't quote me on this, but I think that's correct. And if I remember correctly, the invisible hand that Adam Smith talked about was this thing where if people are in a free economic system, and they're all fighting to improve themselves, their fight to improve themselves ends up improving everybody else, because they want to make more money, they want to be more productive, so they produce better goods and services that benefit everybody else because they want to make more money, they want to, you know, get more customers, so they produce a better pie or produce a better sweater or whatever, and so they want to improve. So this invisible hand is this, you know, where you're trying to improve yourself, and by improving yourself, you inadvertently end up improving everybody else's lives because you make better things available to them. And it's a little bit counterintuitive because, you know, if you're just thinking about yourself, then oh, you're just going to be greedy and you're going to exploit. No, obviously, there's a context there. If you're there to exploit other people and take advantage of them, of course, you're not going to help them. But if you're in a fair society, in a righteous, ethical society, and you're working to improve yourself, you will improve other people inadvertently. But it's counterintuitive. No, I have to explicitly try to improve other people's lives. But Adam Smith was saying, no, if you set up a system correctly, people who strive to improve themselves will improve the lives of others automatically. But those are concepts that defy common sense. You know, it's like when, you know, you lose something to gain it back. If you hold on to it, you will lose it. That doesn't make any sense to common sense. But sometimes that's exactly what happens. You let it go, and that's when you gain it back. You hold on to it, and then you lose it. The other thing is, for example, the concentration of wealth in individuals. If you have a fair system, and we've talked about this, when you allow the concentration of wealth in individuals in a fair capitalist system, not quite like what we have now, but if we have a fair capitalist system, if you allow people to get very rich, that increases the wealth for other people because they can, that allows them to do economies of scale because they have more resources to produce bigger plants that can have a higher capacity. And then the concept of economies of scale kicks in, and then they can produce more goods and services at a lower rate. Then we get goods and services at lower prices than we would have had to pay to acquire them. And then the whole society becomes wealthier. So if you allow, assuming righteous parameters, there's no nepotism, no crony capitalism and all that rubbish. But if you have a fair, clean system of capitalism, if you allow a few people to get very wealthy, you ironically enable the wealth, the increase of wealth for everybody else. And that's counterintuitive. No, we can't let people get too rich because they take up all the money because they see the whole world as this zero-sum game. So if I become very rich, it's because somebody else has to become very poor because that's how they see it. If when I go to McDonald's or Wendy's, I pay $5 and I get a burger, I lost $5 and they gained $5. It's a zero-sum game. But in the economic world, it's not quite like that because a service was exchanged, a product was received, and I am a better, happier person because I eat the hamburger. So wealth was created. But the point is, common sense people say, no, it's a zero-sum game. So you allow a person to get very wealthy, then everybody else is poorer. But no, ironically, in a capitalist system, because it's not a zero-sum game, when certain people are allowed to concentrate a lot of resources and wealth, they can do economies of scale and produce goods and services that benefit others. And this is different from the power clots that we have talked about before. Because in power clots, it's privilege and rank and you obstructing other things, power concentrating in too few people. It's very different from what we're talking about here. This is a free economic system where individuals are empowered to vote with their money and say, I like him, I don't like him, I like his product, I don't like his product. And that's different from what happens in the power clot thing that we talked about before. This is different. So don't confuse them. See, common sense people say, no, it's the same thing. It's not the same thing. So yes, a lot of power is being concentrated in these people who have a lot of wealth. But in a fair system where people have the power to decide, I like your product, I don't like your product, and they cannot be manipulated through crony capitalism or Congress passing a law to benefit this group of people, this wealthy person as opposed to another, which is what happens with the Democrat Party, then if you have a fair system, that actually enables the growth and wealth of everybody. These are counterintuitive concepts that the CSP, the common sense people, cannot achieve or attain to. So what happens is when you go beyond common sense, you begin to see the invisible things that are not initially evident. It's like you just start to discover truths that are initially counterintuitive. See, the common sense is what you see. You know, why is it awake? What you see is what you get, as they would say in computer graphics years ago. What you see is what you get. That's it. But when you go beyond common sense, you start seeing the things that are moving. It's like the spirit behind the things. You start becoming acquainted with the nature of things, the invisible nature of things. And when you become acquainted with that, you discover truths that when you look at them at first, they are counterintuitive, but they are very real. And you know, and that's where conservatives are lost, because they got stuck in common sense land, and they're perishing there. That's why they don't understand why we had to go to the war in Iraq. There were a lot of invisible factors there. If we had not gone to the war to fight in Iraq, the country would have been dead long before 2023. It's like it gave us a chance, a fighting chance, literally, to stay alive a little longer. And we have benefited greatly from it, greatly. And another, like for example, when people put America first, conservatives say America first. Like I saw this headline that yesterday that said, "Why a veteran-owned freeze-dried beef company unabashedly embraces an America First worldview," and that sounds great. Oh, America first, America first. It's ironic, if you put America first, you end up destroying America. What you have to put first is the truth, and if you put the truth first, then America will prosper and be blessed. You know, you let it go, you keep it. You hold on to it, you lose it. And that's what the America First people are doing. Holding on to America. America first. America first. To the hell with the rest of the world. We don't care about the rest of the world. America is number one. And that's how they're going to lose America. If they had said, the truth is first. And hell with America if it goes against the truth. Truth is first. And if truth had been put first, America would have been blessed and would have prospered. And then all that we have wished, all the good wishes for America would have come true. But conservatives don't understand it. Another thing that's counterintuitive is like the slavery of black people. And we've talked about this. We said at the beginning, slavery was a necessary thing. It was necessary. It was good for black people to be enslaved and dragged from Africa to here, because it was a way for them, they had to pay their debt, to get out of the culture of evil, of cannibalism that was in Africa, and to give them a brand new start. The problem is that once they got here, white people, especially in the South, said, oh, this is a permanent thing. Oh, yeah, obviously we have been empowered to bring these people here, and that means that we have a permanent dominion over them. And no, it was for a season. And then they were supposed to be let go and be given the opportunity as equals, as complete equals, as brothers, as fellow Americans. And we didn't do that in 1776, we didn't do it in 1876, and we partially did it in 1964, but by then it was way too late. But this idea that the slavery of black people was a good thing, a necessary thing to help black people, that is counterintuitive. You say, oh, you're a racist and you don't love black people. No, it's because I if you really, really have a love, an abiding love for black people, you're going to say, yes, thank you that this happened, that the slavery happened. The bad thing is what happened after 1732, 1734. We've described that ad nauseum. But saying slavery was a good thing and then was a bad thing doesn't make sense, because common sense people say, oh, either it was a good thing or a bad thing. You can't have it both ways. It was actually both. It was good at the beginning, necessary. It was a punishment. And remember, black people were the ones selling black people to the whites in Africa. It was not white people chasing down black people. It was black people chasing down other black people, black kings selling their fellow black brothers and sisters to white people. Because of the cannibalism going on in Africa, the self-eating that was going on, figuratively and sometimes literally, And they had to be dragged down to be given a new opportunity to pay a price, a redemptive price, for future generations to prosper. But that idea that slavery was good and then bad doesn't make sense to the common sense mind. And for example, another thing that doesn't make sense, criticizing black people to enable them. That is counterintuitive. No, if you like black people, you don't criticize them. If you want to enable them, you praise them, you see how wonderful they are, Black Lives Matter, blah, blah, blah. No, actually, if you want to make Black Lives Matter, you have to tell them how their lives do not matter because of what they're doing with their own lives. But that doesn't make sense. It's counterintuitive. So common sense land is a very deceitful place. And that's where conservatives are stuck. And that's why the country is dying. Thank you very much for listening.